The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Olivia Potts.
And I'm Laura Prendergast.
Today we are delighted to be joined by Marcus Waring. Marcus is a celebrated Michelin-starred chef. He's published a bunch of cookbooks, is a judge on MasterChef The Professionals, and is chef patron of the restaurant Marcus in Knightsbridge and chef of the Gilbert Scott restaurant in St Pancras. Marcus, welcome to Table Talk.
Hi, thank you.
Marcus, we always start at the beginning on this podcast with quite a simple question, but we find we get lots of different answers to it. What was food? What's your earliest memory of food?
Oh, that'll be always the weekends at home with my parents. And it was always a Sunday roast at home when I was growing up. So for as long as I can remember, a Sunday roast dinner was the meal of every single week, every single weekend, I should say. Yeah, potatoes, lots of veg and a cooked meat. That was my biggest first memory. And I think also a lot of baking that my mum always did as well. My mum really did a lot of baking, and she used to batch bake and put a lot of it into the freezer as well. So that for me was my first memory, those two things, cooking with mum and a big Sunday roast.
And were your parents good cooks?
I think at the time, I think you love what your parents cook. You love all the food that when you go and see your gran or your nan. But when I was growing up, I never had any complaints about it. And I always enjoyed the meals. We were always very well fed. My dad was a fruit and potato merchant, so we always had lots of fresh fruit and veg. And we always had two or three vegetables with almost every meal, as far as I could remember. And yeah, it was good food. When I reflect back on it now, I always remember that vegetables were always overcooked, as in my dad never liked any bite in vegetables, no crunch, so we cooked all the goodness out of them. And meat was always no trace of blood. We didn't eat a great deal of fish, and we never had vegetarian food either. So there was always some form of meat in our meal. And that could have been a ready meal from Marks and Spencer's if it was a treat. And just things of that era, the 70s, growing up. Wow, I remember when pot noodles came out. They were like the best thing ever. I mean, that was a Friday treat, a pot noodle, because there was just this brand new thinking idea. Pour water, and you've got a meal, and that was a treat. It's quite bizarre when you think of that today, isn't it?
And so you mentioned that your father was a fruit and potato merchant. Did that influence how you saw food?
I don't think it did. I don't think my father's influence was how you look after food and produce, how we nurture it, we buy it, we nurture it, we store it, we respect it. And I think because when I worked with him, we were working with the basic produce of state of life, fruit, veg and potatoes. You know, it was something that you had to take care of. He bought it in bulk in massive warehouses. And it was a lot of money sitting there. So it was all about the rotation and the looking after of it. And I think that really did rub off on me when I became a chef. I didn't really know it at the time, because when I was a chef, I just got into the kitchen. It was a completely different job to what I was doing with my dad when I was a schoolboy. So, but what he had taught me was how to nurture ingredients. And I think that was one of the best starting blocks I had in catering.
And did you eat out at all with your parents when you were younger? Do you remember your first experience of restaurants?
Yeah, there was a couple of restaurants. My brother was a chef, and there was a few restaurants in Southport. We used to call them a la carte restaurants. There were restaurants that served an a la carte menu, which was not, I won't say unusual, but it was choice menus. They weren't sort of your Happy Meals. They weren't your Pizza Express, their Pizza Hut at that time. This was a restaurant that you went to on a birthday, and that was the only time I ever went out with my mum and dad. It would either be my birthday or one of my brother or my sister's birthday, but not very often at all. And that was the only time. So it would have been either a Chinese meal in a Chinese restaurant. We never went to Indian. The only two places we went to was a steak restaurant, which is the a la carte one, or a Chinese restaurant. That was it. My dad wouldn't venture far away from a Chinese. He would never eat Indian, never Italian. For some strange reason, he called it foreign muck. It's quite bizarre. Hey, we're going back a long time now.
It's a different time. And what about school food? Because I think I'm right in saying that your father was, a lot of the food that he had was supplied to schools.
Yeah.
Did that, I mean, were you at a school where the food that he was supplying was?
Yes, I was. Yeah, and I remember there was two points of my school. There was when you went to the canteen or you went to the school kitchen to have your lunch. There was a point in my education where you would grab a plate, the dinner ladies would put the food on your plate, you'd then go and sit down, and you were basically given your plate of food and that was it. There was nothing else. Then there was a massive turning point where those kitchens became like a canteen and you would have money in your pocket and you could have this choice element of your meal. And then it became a completely different meal experience. And all the fresh fruit and vegetable produce that my father used to deliver into these schools, that became less and less and less. And the reason being is it took manpower, or the ladies, lady power in the kitchens in those days to cook the food. And what I look at it now and I reflect back, there must have been so many cutbacks in schools and education in the food sector that the kitchen used to have 10, 12 dinner ladies in it cooking away all morning. And that got reduced down to sort of 3 and 4. So all this frozen food came in, deep fried food, almost fast food style lunches, and not very healthy. So I remember school food for two different reasons. One being a good old fashioned lunch, and the other one was a choice. And now as a father, the choice element of it was one of the worst things that they did, in my opinion.
No, which did you prefer? Which did you prefer, rather?
For me, I preferred the school meal. I preferred the cooked one because it was very close to what I used to eat at home. So it was a proper meal. When I had the canteen, where I had, my mum used to give me 50 pence for my lunch, £2.50 a week. I never used to spend it. I just used to save it. So I never used to have lunch at school. When she gave me some, I was a big saver. When I was a young kid, and I never used to tell my mum what I used to do with my dinner money, but I just used to go into the canteen and sit down and have a drink. And it's quite interesting because I don't eat lunch now.
Really?
I hardly have any breakfast. I don't eat lunch and I just go straight through to dinner. So it's something that I've been used to as a young boy. People often ask me, I've got weird eating habits. They don't see me eating. I can get up in the morning, have a couple of cups of coffee and not eat till 7, 8 o'clock in the evening. And people find that really strange, but this is the way I've lived.
Is that now because you're tasting when you're in a professional kitchen, or just because that's what you're used to?
Both. I did it as a schoolboy. And then when I went into kitchens, I never ever went into service with a full meal in my stomach. So I used to just taste all the time, and it was a little taste. When you're physically tired in a kitchen and the days and the weeks go by, it takes its toll on you. And when you sit down in a canteen at 6 o'clock at night and you're about to go into a busy service at 7, you find yourself falling asleep. You find that food almost relaxing you. And for me, I always felt that was a going into service at a slow point. That was whenever you saw chefs get into serious deep trouble because they were just not lazy, but they were just tired. And they were just eating food, which is fine because it's fuel. But I always felt, for me, it slowed me down. It made me feel comfortable, warming, so to speak. And you just want to put your feet up and have a kip. But you didn't. You had a six-hour service. You had a six-hour service in front of you. You couldn't fall asleep. So it's the only way I could keep myself alive was to go into service hungry and just taste the food as I go along. Strange, I know.
And what was the point when you decided that you wanted to go into a career in food? Was it when you were at school?
It was when I was at school. It was when those kitchens, school kitchens, turned from to a canteen. My father's business started to slow down and get smaller and smaller and smaller. And it was about 13, 14 years old. My dad told me to go find another career because he knew I was going to go into the family business, but he could see no long-term future in it. So I followed my brother into kitchens, and he was a chef, 7 years my senior. So I followed him. I went to catering college in Southport. So I knew I was going to be a chef from 13, 14 years old. And I was in kitchens from that point on. So I've been in a kitchen since I was 14.
Did you enjoy catering college?
I absolutely loved it. I hated the point of going when I was told I was going to go on a full-time course by my dad and my brother. And God knows why they decided to do that. Because my brother did a part-time course, which meant 4 days working and one day at college and in the kitchens, which was more appealing to me. But they didn't want me to do that. They put me on a full-time course and I absolutely loved it. It gave me the opportunity to catch up on all the school theory that I'd never done. Because school was for me about leaving school at 3 o'clock and going to my dad's warehouse. Homework, reading books, anything that you should do at school, I never did. But when I went to catering college, I really embraced the academic side of it and the sitting in a classroom and studying and reading books, cookery books. They weren't story books, they were cookery books, and that I thoroughly enjoyed. So I became very sharp on the theory of cookery And I found that being in the kitchen is just something that I just could do. I understood food. I've worked in kitchens from the age of 14 in my school holidays. So it didn't feel alien to me being in the kitchen. In fact, it was almost sort of like a duck to water, really. It was where I was at my best in a kitchen.
And which books were you reading at that point that were particularly informative?
There was a cookery books that we were reading as our course, which was the Practical Cookery, the Chef's Compendium, I think it was called. But I also remember Charlie Trotter's books coming out, so professional cookbooks like Charlie Trotter, Daniel Boulud, all the big chefs around London, you had Anton Mozerman, the Roux Brother cookbooks, Nicola Dennis, Marco Pierre White, White Heat, probably the best food cookbook of our era. And probably if you asked any professional chef today, if in my sort of age, you'd say that White Heat was probably the most outstanding cookbook of our generation. These were rock and roll cookbooks. You didn't have Google or internet. You couldn't search for food anywhere else. We had no iPhones. We had nothing. So we just had to read a book and that's all we had. God, it makes me sound old.
Was that time at Catering College and engaging with those books, was that your first contact with classical, I suppose what would have at that point been classical French cookery?
Yeah, there's three points of that for me. There was the catering course itself, those professional cookbooks that were bought for me at Christmas and birthdays by my family. And then there was a TV show called Take Six Cooks and MasterChef, believe it or not, by Lloyd Grossman. But Take Six Cooks was a show about taking six professional chefs. All of them were pretty much based in London at that time. And it was a window into the greatest kitchens of London, the Gavroche, the Waterside Inn, Shane Nico, Marco Pierre White's Harvey's. And it was just the most incredible TV show. I can picture it like it was yesterday. I was watching it yesterday. It was just incredible. And I was just in awe of it. My mum and dad bought me the cassettes because we had video recorder. And they bought me the cookbook that went with the show as well. And I just used to watch them over and over again. I just used to gaze into that cookbook because it was just like watching your best movie. It was just looking at the stars of food. And it was pretty inspirational, to be honest with you. And I wanted to follow that dream. I wanted to go and find those people. I wanted to know who they were. But I had no idea of how to get to them. I had no clue. How do I reach these people? I didn't know what to do.
After you finished at Catering College, how did you then make the leap into the world of restaurants?
Well, that frustration of not knowing what to do next. I mean, in those days, you'd write a letter, you'd put it in the post and you'd hopefully get a reply. I did that and didn't get many replies. In fact, I don't think I got any. I don't even think I put the right address on. Who knows? But I was spotted in a catering competition by a judge from another college who happened to know Anton Edelman at the Savoy Hotel. And when I finished the competition, he pulled me to one side and just said, I'm really impressed with the way you've worked in this competition. I like your style. I like the way in which you present yourself at the stove and at your bench, your hygiene, your precision. Have you any thoughts about moving out of Southport once you finish your course? And would you like to ever consider moving to London? And for me, that was just the biggest and the most memorable opportunity that had ever come my way. It was a door to London. It was a door to one of the best hotels in the city. And I found that incredibly, wow. That was my lottery winning moment.
And what was it like being an 18-year-old who'd never lived in London before, being a commis chef at the Savoy under Edelman?
Horrible. Scary. Nervous. Hated it at the beginning. Felt intimidated by the size of it. But I loved every minute of it in a very strange way. There was a weird connection between it. I was in a place that no one in my college and in my area of town had ever managed to get to. And I'd got to this mecca of food, which was always the five-star hotels. We knew these restaurants outside existed, but these restaurants, your Nicola Dennis, your Marco Pierre White, your Albert Roux, there were places that a young chef couldn't reach. You weren't good enough to go to those kitchens. And so you needed a lot of training before you could enter that type of establishment. So the best place was always a five-star hotel. And it was the most intimidating place. And I hated London. But I felt very safe once I got into the kitchen. I used to remember walking down the Strand at 6 o'clock in the morning and seeing the tramps in the doorways. Not tramps, sorry, people, excuse me. They weren't tramps. They were people sleeping in doorways. And I used to be scared of them. I used to see them as someone who could jump up and get me. I used to march down this road from the tube station, the embankment tube station. As soon as I got to the Savoy Hotel, I clocked in and got my whites on. I just felt like, I made it. Like, I made it to my job every day because I didn't understand London. And I got into that kitchen for the next 16 hours. I was in my sort of zone, but it was hard work. It was really hard work.
Where were you living in London at that point? And when you were cooking for yourself, what kinds of things were you cooking?
Oh, I never cooked for myself at all. I worked 5 days, sometimes 6 days a week, put in 16-hour days. Cooking at home, there wasn't a home. I lived in a place called the PM Boys Club, and it was an industry-subsidised hostel for people outside of London who would apply to go and live there. And you could have been a chef, you could have been a bellboy, you could have been a pot washer, it doesn't really matter. And it was for boys and girls. There was two separate houses, and they provided you with a room. They looked after you on your day off if you wanted looking after. There was things going on. There was no need for me to cook, because you just used to go to the cafe up the road or just didn't really eat a great deal. In fact, there was no cooking facilities there. It was just a room, and there was places where you could go wash your clothes and do some ironing. You know, you'd have a TV, you'd have a kettle in your room, and you just hunker down in there like a sort of hedgehog curled up waiting for your next day at work. Scared.
So tell us about where you went after the Savoy.
I was asked by my father to go and do the one thing I thought I'd never ever do, or go to a place I thought I'd never ever get to. And I'd just come up to 2 years of working at the Savoy, and I was starting to come to the end of it for me. I needed to move on. I was itching to find the next best thing. And Dad always remembered me watching the Take Six Cooks TV programme. And he asked me to go and knock on the door of Gavroche, and literally knock on the door of the door, front door of Gavroche. And I did. He didn't ask me, he told me to do it. Because he always said to me, if you don't go and knock on doors, you won't go anywhere in life. Yeah, you can write as many letters as you bloody like, but if you want to go, you want something in life, go and knock on the bloody door. So I'd like you to get up tomorrow, have a shower, have a shave, put your suit on and go and do just that. And I didn't say no to my dad in those days. And I did it, and I got a job, and I was there a couple of months later. It's the most bizarre experience ever.
what did you say when you knocked on the door?
I just asked to speak to the head chef, and there was a gentleman called Mark Prescott came up. He was a senior sous chef, or the sous chef to Michel Roux Jr. And he happened to be a man from Wigan. So he's a northerner from the northern area like me, and he sort of laughed at my approach. And I think that took note, and that's where we had a chat. I didn't see the kitchen, and I got a letter in the post 2 weeks later with a job offer in a restaurant that you had to wait years to get into. People applied from all over the world, from Japan, from Germany, from America, from Canada. So many different nationalities worked in that kitchen in the 80s. It was extraordinary. And I got a job after just knocking on the door. And I think sometimes it's those points of difference that make you stand out. And I think that's what my dad really, you know, wanted me and my brother and my sisters to do. And I did it. I was only doing what my dad asked me to do.
And what was it like working at Le Gavroche at that stage?
I'd just been to college and worked at only the Savoy, which was basically a massive operation. So you did bulk cookery, and you did banquets, you did room service, you did afternoon teas, and you did a la carte service and for private rooms. When you go into what I could see is the mecca of gastronomy, a 3-star Michelin, one of the top restaurants in the world, I went from 110 chefs in the kitchen to 25, where precision engineering was the point of the day. And that for me was stepping into a chalk and cheese black and white scenario. So I found myself in a very, very difficult kitchen, very complicated in its methods, very technically superb, and the hours were tough, very tough. But I threw myself into it and I worked like a trooper, and I stayed up with the best chefs in that kitchen. I managed to keep up with them, even though I was undereducated to be in there. I'd only been in the industry 2 years, so in fact it was less than 2 years. So I was very, very raw, but I had a burning ambition to succeed and to not fail, and that's what kept me afloat in there.
You're clearly, and clearly always were, extraordinarily driven with this single-minded focus. But as you also say, these kitchens were really hard and the hours were really long, and you were living in quite a strange situation. Did you ever doubt the decision to go into the kitchens? Did you ever think, shit, I should just go and do something else?
Too many of my friends who were on the catering course had left their jobs to go back home to spend time with their boyfriend or their girlfriends, or to be with their mum and dad, or to take the easy option. For me, that was not an option. there was no easy option. Yeah, I may have not liked London, but I felt like a soldier, and I felt like I'm not going to let my team down. And that was the people I worked with, the people that worked next to me side by side, going through exactly the same thing that I was going through. And I always had my father at the end of the telephone at whatever time at night. My father worked up until midnight every night. He was a workaholic, my father. So getting to speak to him was easy. So on bad days, I would pick up the phone and I'd be on the phone for an hour until 1:30 in the morning, just chatting through what was going on. And then I knew when my alarm clock used to go off at 5:30, 6 o'clock the next day, my dad's alarm clock, my dad was going to work as well. So I felt like I was walking down the streets with my father. And he's not dead, my dad, but I am very close to him. And I was then, and I still am today. And so I always felt that he was always with me when I was on that real tough journey. But going home, my dad always used to say to me at the end of most phone calls, whatever crosses your mind, what on earth do you think you're going to come back to if you come back to Southport? What do you think is here for you? What would you do? Go back into your old bedroom? Go back to your old job? Go and get a job in a local restaurant? Where's that going to lead you? And then he bombarded me with the reasons as to why it was a stupid idea crossing my mind. So it was basically, just get on with it. Stop worrying. Just get on with it. And it was tough, but I needed that rock and I needed that voice to drive me forward and give me the confidence to just get on with the job in what was really difficult establishments. But when I look back on it, I wouldn't say they were difficult establishments. I always found myself in a position higher than my age. I always got promoted very quickly. I always got into positions that I wasn't qualified for. And it's because of my father's work ethic that he put into me. And all of that knowledge I had before working with my dad with produce that stood me in good stead in these big kitchens. And I think I must have stood out slightly from the other chefs around me. I had a work ethic that not a lot of people could keep up with at my age. And that's what was a little bit different about probably what I was doing.
At Le Gavroche, one of the chefs that you worked under was Gordon Ramsay. What was he like to work under at that point?
Well, he was a chef de partie. I didn't work under Gordon. He was one of the team. But there was one thing about that chef in that kitchen. Was on my first day, I noticed Gordon above anyone else in that kitchen. And he was one chef that really stood out from everyone else. He was a cook above everybody. You know, Gordon had just spent 3 years, I think, with Marco Pierre White at Harvey. So he was a focused cooking individual, took massive risks, but always delivered. No matter what that restaurant manager threw at him, the amount of food orders that would come in or the pressure that he was under, he knew how to deal with it. And there was not a lot of chefs could do that. So for me, it was about being inspired, seeing that quality of chef in that kitchen. And you could see what your future could be like if you went into the best kitchens and you trained under the best chefs. They molded you into being these focused cooking machines. And that's what we became. And it sounds really odd, cooking machine and focus. But it's what you need in catering. It's what you need to stand out. That stamina to be able to just keep working and thriving for success, but also thriving for excellence in the job you do, trying to master your trade and learn as much as you possibly can. Travel the world and go and see what chefs in other countries are doing. So there's a huge amount of opportunity available to us. Travel the world. The world's your oyster. All these things that your parents used to talk about. There's not many jobs that can take you around the world like catering can. You know, and those were the options that lay in front of us. And those are the things that we all strive for.
You were in your mid-20s, I think, when you received your first Michelin star. Can you tell us about that? You were young.
Yeah, very young. Just turned 25. I was practically 24 while I was cooking. And so 25 when I received it. One of the younger chefs to do that in the UK at that time. And still am. I need a couple like Tom Akins and a few others. It was throwing yourself into an opportunity, but never really knowing how good you really were. And I think what I found out was it was the precision of the cookery. It wasn't about being the best chef at that time. It was about the most consistent chef with an interesting menu. And so winning that accolade was a huge, huge thing for me. But it was one accolade that I didn't even think about. It didn't cross my mind. I got a phone call from Gordon to say that I'd won it. He won his second star. We were working in the same company. He set me up at my restaurant. It was L'Orangère, and I came back from Paris to open it at 25, and he won his second star and I won my first, and we were like, you know, two peas in the same pod back then. So it was a huge celebration for me and him, and we actually celebrated with our girlfriends at the time at Gavroche, and we went out and celebrated. But I did feel that someone had put a very heavy bag on my back and I was carrying it every day. And it was a very difficult bag to carry. But again, you learn to live with that bag and you just keep going with it. So it was amazing. It was a surprise. I didn't expect it. It's not something I worked towards for. It just was given to me. And that was a testament to my training and all the chefs that I'd worked under. So I owe that star to them.
And you've obviously worked in all kinds of restaurants, some in the UK, some in, I think, Amsterdam and New York. How does it compare when you're cooking abroad to working in the UK?
Excuse me, you find cooking abroad sometimes is a bit of a break or almost a bit of a vacation style job. You're sort of abroad, so you're not being watched, so to speak. And so you love the experience, but you also enjoy your new surroundings. The cookery, I always found cooking abroad easier than cooking in the UK. I always felt there was a massive level of intensity cooking in London and in the UK that I never found in working in New York or Amsterdam. I worked in Paris in a 3-star Michelin, and for me it was an absolute breeze in comparison to working at the Aubergine, for instance, with Gordon. It was just different. I always had that itching to wanting to come back to the UK and start my own thing. Even when I was on those trips, I was in those kitchens, I was always thinking about what I was going to do next. So I used it as sort of a bit of a breather. I didn't find New York, Amsterdam or Paris difficult places to work at all.
I wanted to ask you about pastry. You talk a lot about the precision and focus of the professional kitchen, and your Great British Menu custard tart is famous. Is pastry something that particularly appeals to you? Have you spent time in a pastry section, or is it all just one interest cookery for you?
It was the one point I've noticed that it was every chef's Achilles heel, and it was every chef's biggest weakness, and I was never going to let it become mine. To be a good cook and to win accolades, you need to be good across the board of your menu. There's no point in being great at your starters, your main courses and your tasting menu. But when it comes to desserts, you let the whole meal down. So as every chef's weakness, I decided to make it my strength. And so I worked in the pastry section at Gavroche. I worked in the pastry section in Amsterdam. I went to learn bakery with two French bakers in Amsterdam Bakery as well. So I learned a lot about pastry in there. And I think quite a lot of other kitchens, I always made a point of wanting to go and work in the pastry section for some period of time. And if I didn't, I would go in on my day off and go and spend some time understanding. I had a feeling for pastry when I was at college, Kitchen College. My pastry lecturer, Anne Cousins, always says I was always one of the best with pastry. I must have had a cold hands, and it seemed to work quite well with the pastry. And I always managed to line a tart case better than anyone else. And I think, again, remember my mum used to bake a lot. So I used to hang out with her in the kitchen. I used to see the way she used to handle the pastry, the way she used to just make an apple pie and have it in her hand, and she'd spin the plate around and cut all the extra pastry off with a knife. Just little techniques like that that you pick up from your family and your parents that I had in my sort of under my belt. So I made that my strength. And so I became an all-round chef, really.
And Marcus, you've obviously worked in restaurants now for the past 3 decades, since the late 80s. What do you think's changed most significantly about restaurants in London?
Every chef now has got access to social media. They've got access to Instagram, Twitter, iPhones. Everyone's got them in their hands or in their pockets. Or they don't go far away. The difference is today is that everybody's got access to everything that anyone's doing. Nothing is a secret anymore. And you can see everything that everyone else is doing. And the chefs can copy anything and everything. You can get a recipe for whatever you like in life now. It's all out there on the internet. And I think that is the weakness of most modern day chefs, is that there's no difference between a lot of them. They're all doing exactly the same thing because they're all looking at the same things. So my question to the generation behind me is, who's going to be the stars of the future? Who's going to stand out from the crowd? What's going to make that individual different? Because I think restauranting is becoming very similar in every single way across the board. You can get some pretty intense quality food in a local pop-up restaurant that's just popped up in some garage somewhere because that particular chef sees an opportunity, but yet may not have any training to back it up. So there's always going to be, how long is that person going to last without that? You need stability in your cookery. You need a good CV. You need strength to survive, because it's only going to be the survival of the fittest, even more so after the current times that we're in right now. No chef has an easy path, and it's going to be even harder in the future. That's the difference between today and yesterday. social media.
And today, where do you think is exciting to eat? If we were allowed to eat in restaurants today.
I think everybody seems to be doing great things. There's no one standout person I can say, yeah, wow, I've really got to go and eat there. Everybody seems to be doing good stuff, whether it's a fine dining restaurant in central London to you know, a pop-up that's just coming up. That, you know, Chantel's just done one, All's Well. And, you know, these places sound interesting. They're different. Jason Atherton's doing some great stuff. I love Helen DeRose. I'm also really looking forward to trying and seeing what other people are doing outside of London. I love food, and I'm happy to eat anyone's food anywhere and go and visit it. What we don't have, what I don't have time for at the moment, is to go and investigate what everyone's doing. So I really don't, with family commitments, children's school commitments, wanting to watch them do their sport and homework, with my restaurants, TV, books, there is no time for me to go and eat other people's food right now. But I'd also know that as I start to slow down in the future, I'll be doing a lot of traveling and a lot of visiting to some or as many restaurants as I possibly can. But I don't mind whose food I eat as long as someone else is doing the cooking.
As Livy mentioned, we're recording this during the second lockdown. And I imagine it's been a very difficult and tricky time to be in the world of restaurants. How has the pandemic affected your view of the world of restaurants?
I think it's made me reflect. I think my industry is in a tough position, but I think there are a lot of other industries that are suffering. Theatre world, cinema, everything. There's so many things. Everyone's suffering. So I don't think the catering industry should look down on itself and pity that they're in a really, really bad position. We are sociable people, and the job we do is all about being social and having people in front of us. Yes, it's been taken away from us, but we have to accept what it is. I think what we've done as an industry, we're now reflecting on how to move forward. For me personally, it's clarified what I want to do now. And it's clarified to me that I know how I want my business to move forward. When I reopened the Barclay, I made it quite clear to my team that for the first time in my life, in 34 years of being in kitchens, after 6 months of being locked down, I am now going to come to work and I want to enjoy my restaurant. I want to cook the food I want to cook. I want to have fun with my staff. And I want everyone to put a smile on their face, even though that smile is behind a mask. You should be able to see it in their eyes. I want to just have a great time and smile and laugh in my kitchen with my team. And that's something I've never done in my life. But if we can get through this COVID situation, then I think that's the change that I'm going to. In fact, I've already made that change. And for some reason, I seem to be cooking the best food I've ever cooked, because I don't care what anyone thinks about it anymore. I know people are enjoying it because the restaurant's full. And I put things on the menu that I wouldn't normally do. I've got, you know, just big prawns roasted on the grill. I've got steak with these beautiful quadruple cooked chips with the sauces that I enjoy. I've got shrimps on crumpets, which is a dish I used to have as a young boy. And I'm also making a Krispy Kreme donut that I want to put on the menu as well. You know, I don't give a shit anymore. And it seems to be winning, and people seem to really enjoy it, because I think it's showing that the food is coming from the heart and it's not coming from what I have seen somewhere else or what I've read or what I've seen on social media. My chef at the beginning thought I was going a bit mad, but when the food started to come to life and you could see the feedback from the customers, it was one of those I told you so moments. I've been doing this a long time now. And COVID made me realise, you know what, just do what you want to do for now, Marcus, and just get on with it.
So, Marcus, do you think that the sort of the era of the slightly more hostile, slightly more belligerent celebrity chef is perhaps coming to an end?
I think it already has ended. I think it ended as kitchens and social media open kitchens started to come into the equation. And I think there was such a bad vibe about hostile kitchens that it was, if you were running a hostile kitchen, you were seen as somebody who was doing something that was going against the grain of what the industry wanted. And I think a lot of welfare came into stopping chefs from shouting and screaming. Mental health issues had come into the forefront. There's obviously drug problems in the world, but also in catering. But I think mental health is right at the forefront of any chef at the moment. And I think it is something that we must be aware of. It's easy to bully people. And I've done it, and I've had it done to me. But I don't do it anymore. And we in my kitchens haven't done it for a long, long, long time. And I actually don't ever want to see it back in kitchens.
Marcus, finally, a slightly silly question, but what's your desert island meal?
Oh, I just think a so many desert island meals I'd love to have, but I have to say a rib of beef with a Bordelais sauce, roast potatoes and some seasonal vegetables with a great bottle of Bordeaux and finished with some vanilla ice cream. Well, yeah, that would be my sort of desert island meal, yeah.
That sounds perfect. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Marcus, thank you so much for joining us. And MasterChef The Professionals is now on BBC One.
Thank you for joining us on The Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to The Spectator website.
The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.